I'm Taryn Ward.
I'm Stephen Jens.
And this is Breaking the Feed, social media beyond the headlines.
We're taking a closer look at the core issues around social media, including freedom of expression, or free speech as it's sometimes known, to better understand the role that social media plays in our everyday lives and society.
Last episode, we started our close look at Tucker Carlson on X, including his recent interview with Vladimir Putin and his short videos exploring Moscow. This episode, we'll discuss the interview itself and everything that's happened since, all while thinking about what it means for free expression and social media. Let's get into it. The actual interview was just over 2 hours long. If you didn't see it, it was a one-to-one format between Carlson and Putin, who were the only people who appeared on camera. Putin wore a visible earpiece, presumably for translation purposes, and one would imagine Carlson did the same, although I didn't actually see it in the video. Given that Carlson has said during interviews as recently as 2 years ago that he didn't speak any Russian, it's unlikely that he's learned in that time, so I think whether you can see it or not, in some form or other, Putin's words were being translated for him. Putin began with a fairly long and detailed history of Russia and Ukraine, including some of the more recent developments involving NATO, and explained what he thought triggered the conflict. He spoke about the possibility of reaching a peaceful solution and reestablishing communication with the U.S., what he thinks about Zelensky, neo-Nazism, Elon Musk and AI, and finally, imprisoned American journalist Evan Gershkovitz. There's much to think about from this two-hour interview and many, many things that we could focus on. I think it's worth starting, though, with big-picture impressions. Steve, if we step back from the details, and I don't want to get into the weeds just yet, but if you sort of think about the interview as a whole, what were your general impressions? Did it change your perspective? Do you think it changed how others see Putin or Russia? What do you think?
I think that's a really good question. I only watched this interview because of this episode. And, you know, it was 2 hours of my life that I will not get back. No, look, to call it an interview is, I think the first things first, to call it an interview is probably a mistake, because if I expect to see a journalist interviewing a politician, I expect some probing and difficult questions, and there were none. I mean, Putin really was allowed to just monologue for probably 40 minutes at least. And there were very few, I think maybe two slightly probing questions, which he brushed aside. I think he definitely came across as sort of very controlled and calm, much more so than most British and American politicians do. I think you said that when you watched it as well. But, you know, that didn't change my impression of him. I expected him to do that. And it's also easy to do it when you're not really anticipating any difficult questions. What worries me is that people who watched it will have listened to his narrative and accepted it at face value, because it wasn't really a history, it was a narrative, right? This is the story that he has in his head about history, and some of it retconned after the fact to justify the war after he started it. So I think that, but people don't necessarily know that, right? People aren't students of history, they're not students of NATO, they're not students of Russian-American-European relations. And so, you know, if you take him at face value, then it seems reasonable, right? I mean, it doesn't seem reasonable that you would invade a country regardless, but it seems his sort of appearance was of a reasonable man. The fact that it was bullshit is neither here nor there if you don't know it's bullshit. And the interview certainly didn't point that out.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a really good opportunity to think about history and narratives. And I think narratives is a really good and important word. And I think, you know, there's a lot to think about on both sides in terms of Russian narratives and American narratives. And I think most Americans expected to see a different person in that interview because of the narrative. Again, not because of the fact, but I think, you know, whether it's, you know, cartoon renderings or how he's often described in the press, I think a lot of people were ready to see a raving lunatic on camera. And, you know, in a way, that's part of the genius, right? The sort of expectation lowering. The best political candidates do that before a debate. They lower expectations and lower expectations. So, you know, when they come across as just mediocre, everybody's like, wow, he did really well, or she did really well. Although I've seen it less from women candidates than from men. And I think that is interesting. And you and I were talking before we started recording today about narratives and the danger in editing history in a way that suits our narrative, even if it's just a little bit, because it allows room for other people to edit it a lot. And even if our intentions are really good and we're making these little changes to make a point or because we want people to really understand something more fully, there's a real danger there.
Yeah, I think there really is. And, you know, I think we are reaping some of the fruit of, you know, American interventionism during the 60s and 70s and 80s, because there are a lot of dodgy things were done. And that allows Putin to justify doing even more and worse dodgy things, because it's like, you know, well, what aboutism, right? Like, what do you call what you did? And I think, you know, the West generally has been very slow to learn that lesson. You know, that becomes a problem. And I think we've talked before, but I mean, actually the episode before last, about public trust in our politicians, which is very low. Public approval in almost everyone is very low. And so, you know, if you have somebody who can stand up and appear to be strong and in control, because let's face it, he is in control. He controlled every aspect of that interview. Let's not be fooled. In a way that European and North American politicians couldn't possibly achieve, thank God, thanks to, as we said last time, freedom of the press. So I think I didn't expect him to be a lunatic. He isn't Hitler. He's not standing up in front of crowds shouting and extolling them to further acts of barbarity. That's not his way, right? He's a former spy, the KGB, right? And so, you know, that's you would hope, more quiet and controlled. Spies who make a lot of noise don't last very long, right? James Bond, I'm looking at you.
Yeah. I didn't think that would be part of our podcast discussion. So they covered a lot of ground, and I think impressions really varied. I think you were less surprised than I was. I imagine that's probably true generally for Europeans who watched it versus Americans. I think Americans were probably more surprised as a whole. That's my guess, which is based on absolutely nothing except for my own experience and in conversations. But it makes sense, right? Because if you just think about narratives, it makes sense for that reason alone. But there are really two parts of the interview that I think merit closer consideration for our purposes today and for different reasons. But first, Putin's comments on Dostoevsky and the Russian soul and what that might tell us about the target audience here and the larger goals of this interview. I'm going to continue to call it an interview. I know you object, but just for ease of reference. And second, Putin's statements about AI and Elon Musk, for hopefully obvious reasons. If you want to hear this part of the discussion for yourself, it starts around 1 hour 40 minutes. The quote I've pulled is a little bit later in the transcript and reads as follows. Quote, Dostoevsky, who is very well known in the West, is the genius of Russian culture, Russian literature, spoke a lot about this, about the Russian soul. After all, Western society is more pragmatic. Russian people think more about the eternal, about moral values. I don't know, maybe you won't agree with me, but Western culture is more pragmatic, after all. I'm not saying this is bad. It makes it possible for today's golden billion to achieve good success in production, even science, and so on. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that we kind of look the same, but our minds are built a little differently. Now again, we can unpick this any number of different ways, but I think for anyone who has ever really read and loved Dostoevsky, and there are a surprising number of us out there, it's hard not to feel something when you hear or read these words alone, even if you ignore the rest of the interview or expectations about what Vladimir Putin would be like on camera. And then that perfectly smooth transition to speaking about the eternal and moral values, without specifically invoking religion, which I think is important, and definitely not any one religion, which is even more important. And then a sort of, oh, but it's fine, maybe you don't agree, we're all different. So nothing in this feels like an attack. It feels just descriptive and like these are his observations and he's just sharing them. Back to the point, though, which is unfortunately not about my love of Dostoevsky. The question is, who is likely to be moved by this? And I think that's hard to say with any certainty, in part because it's hard for me to imagine who wouldn't want to read Dostoevsky. But we know that sales of his books tend to really increase during times of turbulence. So during COVID, for example, we saw his book sales go through the roof. I first read him myself as a teenager, and I think it's fair to say that those were not unturbulent times for me. So we have Dostoevsky, who is inextricably linked, in my mind at least, but I think for a lot of people, with the Russian soul and with some of my most challenging times personally, with this gentle suggestion about why things are the way they are in the West, or at least why things might be different than they are in Russia.
Yeah, it was a clever piece of rhetoric, wasn't it? I mean, I'm going to pull out all of my cynicism here and say that he knew exactly what he was doing. And whilst it didn't sound like an attack, it clearly was an attack. He called the West essentially immoral and feckless, because that's the opposite of being moral and thinking about the eternal. And then pretended that this isn't the whole of his shtick, that Russian superiority isn't a fundamental part of his ideology and the way he sells his approach to the Russians. And that's really clever writing, whether it was him or whether it was somebody else. He delivered it brilliantly, but it's scarily effective in the way that it delivered that message. It was very subtle, but there's no way that you can read that written down and not see that it was a very, very subtle attack, which talked to Russian superiority. And I think he was talking to two audiences there. He was definitely talking to the West, saying, your leaders are moral and feckless, and many of immoral and feckless, and many of us would believe that from all sides of the political spectrum. But it's a bit rich coming from someone like Vladimir Putin, who by any stretch of the imagination could not be called moral, not by any understanding of the word I have anyway. So, you know, it really was interesting. And the problem was he got away with saying it without being challenged on it, right? This is back to my original point. You say something like that as Biden or Rishi Sunak or someone, not that they ever would, but if you did, you'd get bloody questions about that.
Yeah, and I think that's true, because that's how we sort of see journalism, right? It's almost like a deposition in some cases, especially in the UK. I mean, I think a lot of Americans are really surprised at how hard the press goes for the PM, because you wouldn't necessarily see that even in the US. You see some of it with Biden, but, you know, I can't help but think about President Trump and the way he deals with press. You know, he hasn't shown up for debates. He's only doing interviews where he really controls the narrative. And it's hard not to see that and listen to this and think, there's something not right here. But despite all of this, I'm very unlikely to be the target audience here, right? So Tucker Carlson is not my cup of tea. And that's the nicest thing I can say about a man who nearly ruined bow ties for me. And I have little reason, objectively speaking, to complain about how things are in the West, where I hold a fairly privileged position. By all accounts, things in my life have gone pretty well and are going better now than they ever have. This isn't for me. Carlson ends one of his clips, I think it was the one in the Russian grocery store, with a declaration that he's been radicalized. He says that what he saw in that grocery store radicalized him, and he repeats it, radicalized. And this is, I think, one potentially really important clue on the target audience. Again, it's difficult to say with any certainty because these things can be really, really complex and there are layers. But there's a story that became really popular on X earlier this week about a Canadian family with 9 children who relocated to Russia with 8 of them. This all happened a few weeks ago, and I'm fairly certain it happened before the Carlson interview, and certainly the wheels were put in motion for it before the interview. So I'm not suggesting this interview was the cause, only that it might tell us something more about the target demographic, at least in North America. again, this family was Canadian, but I think we can sort of lump Canada and the U.S. together, at least in this instance. You can hear directly from the family, mostly the father, on YouTube, where they invite you to consider one of several links to contribute funds to their cause. The short version is that they were farmers in Canada. They'd moved around a bit. They had a 200-acre farm on which they constructed their own home over the course of several months. And then after months of planning, they sold everything and moved to Russia. When they transferred their money to Russia, things got complicated because some anti-money laundering red flags were triggered. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on this because these regulations can vary quite a bit from country to country, and it's not relevant, really. And of course, they tend to take Americans in particular by surprise because it's so different to our system. But based on the video the family made, it sounds like because a chunk of their income came from cash-based transactions from their farm stand, they couldn't meet even the minimal verification standards. So they were accused initially of breaking a law. To further complicate things, they received contributions from the links in their videos, which is also difficult to link to specific sources. So you can imagine why this would set off red flags, really, in most countries. And actually, I think probably one thing I do have in common with this family is that neither of us understand Russian banking regulations, or to be fair, how to navigate a Russian mall. But that's a different video too.
Yeah. There's so much in there to unpack, isn't there? I mean, first of all, Tucker Carlson, yes, I love bow ties. I don't really wear them. Not that I look particularly like him. He has the most punchable face in the world, and I happily do not have quite such an offensive face, even when wearing a bow tie. But bow ties are cool. Tucker Carlson is not. This whole idea of radicalization, it goes along with, doesn't it, the fact that Russians, at least the ones we see in European Russia, are all white, and their society is being run for their benefit. Now, I mean, obviously it's being run for their benefit because that's the majority of the population. But, you know, there's a story being told there. And of course, you know, he went on about how cheap the groceries were. Yeah, salaries are crushingly low as well, mate. And what he didn't ask anybody about was the fact that Putin had to go on TV earlier this year, I think maybe earlier this year, later last year, and explain why the price of eggs had gone up 42%. Can you imagine what would happen in the American press if a staple food item increased almost by half? It would be carnage. You know, there's a question to be asked there, right? So I think that's, Carlson didn't present, you know, anything that was genuinely informative. Right. And so, you know, even though by American standards, what he threw in that trolley were pretty cheap. If you're a Russian, that was more money than you can spend. That's the point. And, you know, this Canadian family, this is an interesting story since I actually, you know, live in Canada and Alberta is the province next door. It's considered, you know, by most Canadians to be the Canadian equivalent of Texas. You know, it thinks of itself very differently and is quite, you know, right wing and loud. Lovely people, don't get me wrong, neighbors, we love you all, but there are some issues. And, you know, to move from there to Russia seems like an extremely odd move, particularly when you've got 8 children going with you. I mean, obviously, it wasn't well planned, because if you are going to move countries, as you and I both have, you actually look at all of the rules around transferring money and all of the other things that you need to take, like household goods and whatever, because there are rules everywhere. So, you know, I despair and I feel very bad for the children who presumably had nothing to do with the decision to move to Russia. But it is interesting, isn't it, that you would pick Russia as a place to go because you were concerned about restrictions placed on your freedom in Canada.
Yeah, so that was, you know, this whole conversation is a bit of an aside, but I think it's important. It's an important clue about the target demographic. And I think your comparison of their province to Texas is relevant in thinking about that, because Texas often thinks of itself as its own country. And I think when you see yourself that way, it maybe changes how you think about some things. You know, this family moved to Russia for a number of reasons based on their own statements, but largely because they felt Canada had lost its way economically, socially, and culturally. Sort of the big three, really. And their interview about why they moved, which is also available on YouTube, is an interesting watch. You know, I'm sure body language experts have all kinds of commentary on this, and I won't get into it. But, you know, the husband says Canada is not the country it used to be. And he specifically points to left-wing ideology, LGBTQ, trans, and a lot of things we don't agree with what they teach there now, in his words. There are a couple of things that are really interesting in there, and we hit on some of this a little bit yesterday, but the fact that it's left-wing ideology is a really interesting little nugget to have in there. But it all starts to paint a really interesting picture of, again, who is this video aimed at? And you can look at Tucker Carlson's own views on some of these issues and understand that there is a clear, if not entire, overlap.
Yeah, there is, isn't there? I mean, you know, Tucker Carlson made his career on race baiting and being misogynistic, and that sold. It sold well enough for him to be one of the top earners on Fox and for Fox. And, you know, that is it's a demographic which, let's say, it's in the rural communities, it's in places like Florida, it's in places like Texas, where, you know, as we've said previously, you couldn't imagine Republicans agreeing to the burning of books. And now it's become, you know, stock in trade, complaining about books in school libraries and banning them and burning them. And, you know, that's just not the sort of thing that you associate with a party loving freedom and freedom from government interference, is it? But it talks of this culture war which has been set up, right? And this interview was a continuation of that culture war. It's like, you know, this is a society run for the benefit of its white citizens. White wasn't actually stated, was it? But it was clearly there. And, you know, you could live in a utopia like this. All you have to give up is any claim to freedom, because you can go to jail here and be put to death for virtually anything, and certainly all of the things that Tucker Carlson and his buddies have done, criticizing the government, for one. You know, there's a list available online of all the political opponents of Vladimir Putin who have died in suspicious circumstances. It's quite a long list, and it's an even longer list when you take into account journalists, which Tucker Carlson is trying to reinvent himself as. So, yeah, you know, it was more grist to the culture war that is manipulated and accentuated by the algorithms and social media, as we've talked about before. It was really offensive to me, the whole experience.
One of the points that you just made about the target audience and who is this likely to appeal to, just based on who Tucker Carlson is and the audience he attracts. And I think, again, when you step back and you look at Tucker Carlson has been a huge Trump supporter for a long time. And, you know, you start to think about these demographics and what the overlap looks like. It starts to paint a really interesting and strange sort of picture. And, you know, you think about who might think about making a move like this and how they're likely to vote in the next election in the U.S. It starts to be really interesting. And then, you know, Trump didn't say anything about Navalny's death for a while. And then he did and compared himself to him, which was a really, it's just been a really strange week. You know, you have a week where Putin came out and said he'd rather Biden were president, which I'm not sure anybody believes or understands how that could be true. And then, you know, Trump comes out and says he's basically been treated like Navalny. It's just, it feels a little upside down and inside out. And I don't know if I'm missing something or if that's just how it is now.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the steps in sort of, you know, controlling what people think, right, is making sure that they don't believe anything that they're told. And you know, Trump spent his entire presidency lying, aided and abetted in those lies by both social media and the inability of the American press to ask difficult questions of politicians. I mean, that came to my mind when you said that, right? It's almost inconceivable that American news service would call up the president a liar. Boris Johnson was called a liar many times by lots of people in the British press because he lied, right? And it's important to call a spade a spade.
It is so different. I mean, they are not shy, and they go for it. They really do.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I would love to have seen an interview with, you know, the Hard Talk team or one of the other hardcore British, you know, political journalists who asks those tough questions and is, you know, completely unfazed when facing dictators, because that would have been an interview worth watching. So yeah, it's clear that it's the same sort of demographic, and we're convincing people that they are worse off because of, you know, race and because of, you know, gender issues and because of gay people. You know, all of those people are taking your stuff, whether it's your jobs or your college places or your place in society, your voice is being stolen, they're being preferred. You know, it's a very attractive narrative to an unemployed, unemployable white person, white man, let's say, that it is not your fault that your life is the way it is. It is the fault of people that you will never meet. You know, and I think this is the story which Putin is selling. It's like, it's not my fault, having run your country for more than 20 years, that your lives are crap. It is the Ukrainian neo-Nazis, and it is the European Union, and it is NATO. It's their fault that your life is crap. And of course, there's a resonance between that and America, because to convince that demographic in America that those socialist Europeans are part of the problem isn't actually that difficult, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. You know, I was just thinking about, I think I sent you the Jon Stewart clip of, you know, he sort of talks about Tucker Carlson, or he's reacting to Tucker Carlson's videos on the show. And I think for a lot of people on the left who might have felt some of the same pulls on their heartstrings when Dostoevsky was mentioned, I think watching that, any bit of sentimentality was quickly ripped away. And I wonder if they're worried Jon Stewart on the right, and Tucker Carlson sort of isn't, because he's not funny. He is meant to be more entertainment than news, but he's not a comedian. That's not sort of the purpose. But if there were a sort of comedian on the right who were good at doing this, whether that might be a different thing. But before we run out of time, we have a whole second part that I think is worth discussing that is really relevant to what we're talking about this series. And that's the part of the conversation that steered towards AI and Elon Musk. This would be worth discussing anyway, because it's really interesting. But the fact that Musk shared this interview on X, and he said he was watching it, and that as a result, at least in part, the interview had more than 200 million views, I think that makes it particularly relevant for what we're thinking about and talking about in terms of free speech and free expression and social media. So first, Putin commented that there are reports that Musk had already had a chip implanted in a human brain in the U.S. and seemed really interested in this, but wasn't quite sure, you know, if it had happened or not. And then he said, and this is a quote, "I think there's no stopping Elon Musk. He will do as he sees fit. Nevertheless, you need to find some common ground with him. Search for ways to persuade him. I think he's a smart person. I truly believe he is. So you need to reach an agreement with him, because this process needs to be formalized and subjected to certain rules." I think two things stand out here. First, again, Putin comes across as entirely reasonable, which is true, as we've said, of the whole interview. But it's hard to argue with anything he says here. Even for me, you know, I'm not Elon Musk's biggest fan, but it's hard to take out any one of those things and sort of pick it apart. And the second thing, and this is really important, it seems impossible for Musk to find anything in that to object to.
That's right. It is really interesting, isn't it? You've got one of the most powerful men in the world talking about another one of the most powerful men in the world in quite an unusually respectful terms. through the intermediary, the man with the most punchable face in the world. So you've got Putin being uncharacteristically respectful, but it's really interesting that he chose to talk about this very important but very minor part of Elon Musk's empire, right? This brain implant, the brain chip implantation. I mean, John Stewart would have probably done a brilliant piece on this, comparing, you know, the implanted chip with the self-driving mechanism in Tesla. There is a lot of sick humor in that. But, you know, first of all, the implantation of that chip was subject to a significant amount of government regulation and discussion between the FDA, the medical community, the patients, because it's an experimental thing and it has to be done with informed consent in the West. But he didn't talk about Tesla, you know, solar power and batteries. He didn't talk about X. He talked about this one thing. And what was really interesting was he didn't talk about Starlink, which has been a real thorn in his side in Ukraine, because the Ukrainians are using that system to communicate. He stayed away from anything and talked about this one issue. And you have to think that if he had said something critical of Elon, and based on what we've said in previous interviews about what Elon has done to people who are critical, he knew that he wanted this promulgated and shared by somebody with a significant number of followers, and that's not Tucker Carlson. That's Elon Musk. And so if he says something nice, or if he's pretty bland, then he's going to get shared, because they share certain worldviews on other topics, don't they?
Yeah, and I think something you said there is really interesting, because there's sort of a parallel. You know, earlier in the episode, I sort of drew a parallel between the kind of interviews Putin wants to do and the kind of interviews Trump wants to do. But I think Elon Musk is sort of the third parallel here. And again, I'm saying parallels because I'm not saying they're exactly the same, but I'm saying this idea of, I want to control exactly what we talk about, exactly how the conversation unfolds, or I'm not going to talk to you at all. And if you say something I don't like, I'm going to do everything I can to shut it down. And that's, you know, we've seen that with Trump on Truth Social, and we've seen it sort of across the board. And so, again, I think one of the problems with this is it means that when we talk about free speech and free expression, whether it's in Russia or China or North Korea, it makes it really hard for the international community to take anything America says seriously. And it's not just because our interviews look different to what you see in the UK, which are brutal. They are brutal, and I do not envy them. But, you know, we can't sort of have it both ways. Either this is what we believe and this is what we want, and everyone has to play along, or we don't. And if the rule is, well, if you're really rich or really powerful, those rules don't apply to you, the rest of the world is catching on to that approach, and we've already lost much of the moral high ground. I really don't think we can afford to cede much more of it. So along those lines, days after this interview appeared on X, the Russian prison service reported that Alexei Navalny had died. As we record this episode, the exact causes of that death remain unclear. There's been speculation in a number of different directions, but I don't want to comment further because we are still waiting for some real evidence to emerge from somewhere. And it's largely beyond the scope of our conversation here. Anyway, we've already established my limited understanding of biology, so let's set that aside. But you might expect that Musk, who we've already said has weighed in on a number of different political issues recently, especially in the direction of Russia, didn't weigh in on this, except yesterday, Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, had her Twitter account suspended for violating X's rules. Again, as of the recording of this episode, that account has been reinstated, and X has blamed the flagging of that account on a mistake. There may be other things going on here that we don't know about, but these are the facts as we know them. And it doesn't paint a very flattering picture of really anyone involved.
No, it really doesn't, does it? And it comes back to this thing about, is there such a thing as a free speech absolutist, right? Because if you're a free speech absolutist, you should be absolutely appalled disgusted by the imprisonment of Navalny. And I'm not even sure there are words to describe how outraged you should be at his death in prison because he was an opposition to Vladimir Putin. Because, as we talked about in the last episode, the founding fathers knew how important the press was and how important it was to not have government suppression of conversation about itself and about any difficult issue. That is the primary purpose of at least half of the First Amendment. They knew it was important. And that's the thing which Musk and Carlson did not talk about. There is no free press in Russia. In the former Soviet Union, there was press, but it was controlled by the state. Twitter exists, but my concern with Twitter right now is that it serves its purpose at the whim of its owner. Not its board, not the public that it serves, but at the whim of its owner, who has control of the strings that drive the algorithm. And therefore, it isn't a free platform. Freedom of expression can't exist on a platform which is controlled and driven by an algorithm controlled by one man. And the banning of Navalny's wife, regardless of what minor technical glitch caused it, is absolutely disgraceful. And there was no apology, as far as I could see.
Certainly not from Elon Musk, at least as of the recording of this. We've not seen a public apology from him. Something you said there about free speech absolutists, I think, is worth picking up on. So I grant that in theory, such a person could exist in the same way that a skeptic could exist, a true skeptic. But it reminds me of the guys in my philosophy major classes when I was at university who sort of played with this idea of skepticism. And very quickly, they found themselves chasing their tails and sort of stuck in this very weird loop. And they couldn't think themselves out of it. And I think free speech absolutism is a bit like that. Because if you really believe that, there are all kinds of follow-ons that become increasingly absurd, really. And so I don't think, I certainly don't know anyone who's a free speech absolutist. So anytime I hear somebody claim that they are, that's an immediate red flag. And I think it should be for anyone. Because, first of all, define your terms. And second of all, no, you're not. All that does is tell me you either don't understand free speech or you're pretending not to understand free speech. And I think for Elon Musk, it's more likely the latter than the former. I don't know if that's better or worse. Ultimately, one of the things I think that makes us uncomfortable with Putin is this idea that he's a one-man show. And there don't appear to be many checks on his power. You know, we talked about the founding fathers and how important that was to them. But, you know, whether we think about it in terms of how the government operates or what the press reports, it feels like he has the authority to make arbitrary rules if he wants to, even if they limit or violate basic human rights. And then there's little recourse. Well, whether you're a political leader or somebody who controls a platform that is really important for free speech and expression and therefore democracy, that's a really worrying thing. And we're right to be uncomfortable with that idea.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on. And this is, I think, one of the major problems that we have with the way social media works right now and the future of democracy, right? Because this is not, it's not free. Arbitrary decisions are made, which are in the benefit of no one other than shareholders or owners. And that's a major problem, you know, and that's not unlike some of the challenges that America faced with monopolies in the 19th century, you know, and it regulated its way out of those problems. That was the right thing to do, although I'm sure there are many Americans who would argue with me. And I think, you know, the congressional hearings we've seen recently were the start of an interest in regulating social media. One hopes we just exist in a very different political and social climate now, and I think it's going to be an uphill struggle for them.
We'll post a transcript of this episode with references on our website.
Until next time, I'm Stephen Jones.
And I'm Taryn Ward.
Thank you for joining us for Breaking the Feed, social media beyond the headlines.